Well, I don't know how I should feel anymore. I mean, I get back here, and I've been told that during my absence, we had our record attendance in the class. So, I want to take this time to thank Kathy for doing so well in class. It was just really thrilling for me to hear all the reports of what happened last week. So it was great. And things were great for me as well. I was in Georgia most of last week and was in a place called Buckhead Community Church. And it was really good for me because you probably haven't heard this, but our church is planning a fifth service. There's a lot of, it's been planned for the past 2 years, but this year we may actually see it happen. Sierra Madre wants to start a service that's focused, particularly designed for people who've never really been to church or considered the Christian faith or been exposed to the Bible before. A service designed for secular people. And I've been traveling around the country participating with other churches who've developed such services and had an opportunity just last Sunday to see one of the better examples of that. And it's great just for me to be involved in that and to come back to this church and share some of the things that people have done elsewhere and how we can make it work. But this church, the place was really packed, and large numbers of secular people came. And just how well people respond to comedy, especially to satire that satirizes the speaker and the message, and just how that gets people to relax a little bit and ease their tension. And we're just going to have to work with all these preachers and teachers and let them know that they got to take a bit of razzing before they get up there and deliver their message. But it was fun. It's really good. And it was a very special church, too, and it was loaded with some of the nation's top Christian apologists. You got Ravi Zacharias, and you got William Lane Craig, and they got a whole club there of people who do this, so they're really well-staffed. But likewise, our church has the opportunity to bring in our Reasons to Believe volunteer team and to provide some of the teaching and instruction for this fifth service. So I appreciate your prayers for that. Kathy and I attended the overflow service. This place was really full today, but that's where we're planning to do this fifth service because we need kind of a stage area. Basically, the plan is you replace the choir with a drama team, and the drama team focuses on comedy and satire, and you seat people around tables. And they did a real funny play. So, well, I mean, I was speaking about the creation of the cosmos, etc., and so they had this group come on, and it was this lady reaching out to a skeptic. And she was trying to draw him into her group. And, you know, it's interesting where they had this big cult thing happen this week. That's what they were doing. This was a cult. And they were trying to draw this young man into this cult and recruit him to the group. And so he reluctantly attends this thing. And this high priestess comes out there in her gold metallic outfit. And she begins this chant, and it starts off as Rosie, and then it eventually blends into zero, right? And the whole cult was based on the idea, from nothing we come, from nothing to return. We're all nothing, everything we do is nothing. And finally, in the middle of this thing, as they get into this frenzied dance, they unveil this statue, and it's a huge zero that they all bow down and worship in front of. So it was kind of fun. So, yeah, he kept raising questions, and that's kind of how I was introduced, because all these questions were raised, and really the way they developed their comedy is that their comedy doesn't try to give answers, rather it raises issues and pokes fun. And, so often I've seen Christian drama where they try to preach through the drama. This is much more palatable, I believe, for secularists. And it's something you can laugh at, and it raises questions, but doesn't provide the answers. That's to be done within the group through discussion and instruction, which is really a better way to do it. That way people don't feel like they're being preached at. So it's good. We learned a lot of good things, and every time I do one of these things, I pick up some ideas we can bring back here. So appreciate your prayers for what's developing here. But, you know, I was naive going to Georgia. I had to keep telling people I'm Canadian, I'm not American, so excuse me for stepping on toes. But I made this, you know, I asked this question about, well, this is Atlanta. And you know, we'd read all about the Civil War in our Canadian history. In fact, Kathy says I probably learned more about it than she did. But you know, I knew about all these battles that took place around Atlanta. So I was just asking the guys who were driving me around, well, you know, is there anything you can see about this? And says, well, you have to realize that the city was burnt to the ground and rebuilt. There really isn't much left. And Dr. Ross, we don't call it the Civil War in this state. It's called the War of Northern Aggression. So, and I saw a lot of evidence of, you know, Confederate flags, and they refer to it as Dixieland and Land of Dixie, etc. So I gradually learned to keep quiet and listen rather than pose these kinds of questions. But I'll tell you, when I was at Toccoa Falls, they were so impressed that we got two people attending this class from Toccoa Falls College. I says, wow, they had no idea their graduates got this far above. He said, we send them all to the mission field. I said, well, Los Angeles is a mission field, so that's why they're out here. So, but it was really a wonderful college. It's the first Christian college I've really had a chance to teach at where I didn't get a lot of opposition. I mean, I'm always a little bit nervous going onto a Christian campus because I'm either going to be running into theistic evolution or young earth creationism. And so no matter which, because that's typically what most Christian colleges are like. They're either theistic evolution, preaching Darwinian evolution, and you know, God has no role in how we get here except to create the universe, maybe the origin of life, and that's it. Or the young earth doctrine. And so either way, I'm the enemy, and I get attacked, and you know, it's much more comfortable to go on a secular campus where those kinds of things happen to a lesser degree. But this place was different, and I think I figured out why it was so different. It's a Christian campus that's not so much a Bible college, but a missionary training college. They kind of see themselves as the Prairie Bible College of America. You know, the whole focus is about 1,000 students, and they're preparing themselves for careers in missions or evangelism. And just having that evangelistic hermeneutic made such a difference. I found out the professors were already using our books in their courses, so that kind of paved the way. And the students readily saw the evangelistic advantages of our style and our approach, and I had a wonderful time there. It's one of the most receptive audiences I've ever dealt with, and I was also impressed with how deeply they knew their Bibles. You know, it's always been a frustration of being to go on Christian campuses and discover that their depth of Bible knowledge just isn't there, even though they've taken 3 or 4 years of Bible. But this place does not stress a lot of courses in Bible. Now, they have a chapel, and students are basically expected to study the Bible on their own. They don't have courses on that. But boy, they sure knew. This was the highest level of Bible knowledge I'd ever encountered on a Christian campus. So very impressed. Glad I went there. And yeah, the falls were great. I didn't know they had waterfalls that high in places flat as Georgia, but boy, they did all right. So it was really good. I also heard a joke there on the campus. Maybe, you know, I sometimes I cause, was that tape on? I don't know. Last time, Kathy's about flinching there. No, that's all right. It's all right. But the joke they were sharing with me was, you know, there was this young couple, and it was the day before they were to get married, but they had an automobile accident. So they found themselves up in heaven. And, you know, they talked to the principals up there and said, you know, we were just a day away from getting married. We're young. Couldn't we get married up here? And I said, well, it's an unusual request, but we'll see what we can do. But it's going to take a couple of days. And a couple of days went by, and they said, it's going to take a week. A week went by, and they said, we're going to need another week. After 3 weeks, they said, okay, you can get married now. So they got. And then about 2 weeks went by, and they came back to the same principals and said, you know, marriage is so unnecessary up here. And we really don't need it. Can't we go back to the way we were before? And they said, look, it took us 3 whole weeks to find a minister up here. And now you want us to find a lawyer? So...
So,
so, I guess lawyers don't have even a much higher reputation in Georgia than they have here. All right. I just so much appreciated what Dick said about what happened in San Diego, and just his perspective that, hey, our first parents, Adam and Eve, committed suicide by taking poison. We shouldn't be too surprised. We shouldn't be too condemning. This happens. And we're going to be getting into that as we get into chapter 2 and 3. Because that's literally what they did. They committed spiritual suicide. But God was able to work through that. So I just thought that was a point he had never made before that I really appreciated very much. Before we get into what I was planning to teach on today, I will honor your requests. I do have a couple of books in our Reasons to Believe office that deal in depth with this whole issue of Easter, the calendar, the Passover. And what Tom is getting at is that, and maybe you got other questions, but what Tom was getting at is so many secular people have this question. Well, we celebrate Good Friday, okay? And then we have Resurrection Sunday. But doesn't the Bible tell us that Jesus was in the earth for 3 days and three nights? And hey, you start with Friday afternoon, and you got Sunday morning. That doesn't really add up to 3 days and three nights. How do you deal with that? Excuse me. How do you deal with that issue? And a lot of people have been skeptical about the Christian faith because they see this as an irreconcilable problem. Well, maybe just to put your mind at ease, certainly the first century church didn't see it as an irreconcilable problem. It was the whole heart of the Christian faith was the death and resurrection of Jesus and the fact that he precisely fulfilled the prophecy that he made. Just and they went around saying that. He said beforehand that he would be dead 3 days and three nights, and he would raise bodily, and here he is. I mean, here's the evidence that this is really taking place. So the fact that the early church, right from the very beginning of the spreading of the message in the book of Acts, as we heard this morning, made reference to the 3 days and the three nights, means that they did not perceive this as a problem. Now, I'm not sure the resolution to that problem that's most commonly taught in the commentaries is correct, but I'll give it to you. And I'll give you what I think is a better answer. And that is to say, well, in the Jewish culture, any part of a day would be considered a day and an evening. So even if Jesus was put on the cross late in the afternoon or early evening of Friday, that would count as a morning and an evening. And no matter when he was raised from the dead on Sunday, whether it was first thing in the morning, and text tells us it was very early in the morning. I mean, the women got up early and went to the tomb, and he'd already been raised from the dead. So it was very early in the morning. But their point is, within the Jewish culture, any part of the day would be considered a day and a morning. So it says it's still 3 days and three nights. My problem with that is that what Jesus is quoting from is the book of Jonah, as Jonah was in the belly of the whale, or the throat of the fish. I mean, belly of the whale is what people say in English, but the text actually is referring to the throat of this large fish. Maybe the shark. There were sharks that were over 40 feet long in the Mediterranean at that time. So, but as he was there for 3 days and three nights, likewise the Son of Man would remain in the grave for 3 days and three nights. And certainly in the context of Jonah, is understood to be more than 36 hours. a full 72 hours as opposed to 36. Now, perhaps between the time of Jonah and the first century church, the style of the language had changed, but the fact that Jesus is so obviously quoting from Jonah makes that interpretation suspect. And incidentally, I've heard that from non-Christians challenging the Christian faith, saying you can't get off that easy. Some of them are aware that it's a quote from Jonah. As I mentioned, I've got a couple of textbooks in my office, and perhaps the best one is based on a thesis. There is a gentleman who got a PhD in theology for writing a thesis on this particular problem, later got it published as a book. Excuse me, but I can't remember his name. I can bring the book next week and you can see it. It's a nice little thick thing, and another book that makes the same point. But what was the heart of this thesis is that Jesus was crucified during Passover week. And if you go back into the book of Exodus, you discover that there is a special Sabbath at the beginning of the Passover week and a special Sabbath at the end of the Passover week that's distinct from the Sabbath that would follow the end of the weeks that they would be celebrating. And therefore, around Passover week, within a span of, say, 7 to 10 days, you could literally have four Sabbaths, between 3 and 4 Sabbaths. And so what this person tried to do in his thesis, he was more interested not in the problem of solving the 3 days and three nights, but of trying to come up with a date for the birth of Jesus and the death of Jesus, and trying to tie down the biblical chronology of these New Testament events. That was really the heart of the thesis. So a lot of the chapters deal with our best evidence for the date of the birth of Jesus, but also the best evidence for when he was crucified. And what he was trying to do was look at the calendar and figure out what years around 30 AD or 26 AD, depending on your differing interpretations, somewhere around those dates, what would be, where would we find a Sabbath that would be falling on Thursday and Saturday? Because he says if it's 3 days and three nights, then if Jesus were to be put on the cross before the Sabbath that fell on Thursday, and marking the end of the Passover celebration, and then Saturday being the regular Sabbath, and then his being raised bodily from the dead on Sunday morning early, that would give you the 3 days and the three nights and would be consistent with the book of Jonah. And so we tried to go through the calendars as best as we know them, trying to figure out which years would give you a Sabbath on a Thursday and a Saturday. And he found a few options. So he really didn't solve the problem, but he gave what he thought were the best two dates for the crucifixion of Jesus based on the necessity of having a Sabbath on Thursday and having a Sabbath on Saturday. Now, if you go into the Gospels, the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, if you take the interpretation there's only one Sabbath, you've got to make everything happen around Saturday, you find you run into inconsistencies in terms of what needs to be done to prepare the body of Jesus for burial and the women coming with the spices. And that's one of the points he makes, is that you have this inconsistency that's very difficult to resolve if you have just the one Sabbath. And you're trying to make out, well, if you got part of a day, it counts as a morning and an evening. But if you got two separated Sabbaths with a day in between, then there's no problem integrating the accounts of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. All the events that they speak of can be made consistent with all three of the authors of the Synoptic Gospels. And so he says that's really the better way to go. You can squeeze in all the events. There's enough time for the body of Jesus to be prepared and yet for the women to come following the Saturday, because no work was allowed to be done on a Sabbath, Thursday, as well as Saturday. And trying to make everything happen within Friday presents you with a problem. So that's basically the take on it. If you had other questions on it, go for it. Yeah, Tony?
This verse that you're kind of quoting and going back and forth across, the women going to the tomb, hidden in there is really the answer to it. Let me read it to you. Now after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn towards the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to look at the grave. Let me read the subtitles from the Greek. But late of the Sabbaths, at the drawing upon toward one of the Sabbaths, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to view the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Sabbath is plural here. Sabbath, sabbaton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There it is, two Sabbaths, right. Right. As many scholars pointed out, if you look at what was on the body of Jesus, it would take a long time to get ready. You're not going to do it in a few minutes. The grave clothes that were put on him, it's essentially like preparing a fiberglass swath around a body, and the text tells us it was 3 inches thick. See, how did he get the 3 inches? The weight. That it weighed a talent. He had a talent's worth of rosin and linen strips on his body. And that would take a long time to prepare, because you would put one layer of these linen cloths on the body, you press the rosins in it, you have to wait till it sets, then you put another one in, then you put more rosin on top of that, wait till it sets until you build it up to the weight of a talent, which is either 75 or 100 pounds, depending which talent you use. And that's what I meant. There just simply isn't enough time, reasonably, if you try to make it all happen in the brief period that you have of just that one Sabbath. But yeah, thanks for bringing that point out, Tony.
That's not isolated either. There's a couple more.
Could you get another one there? That'd be great.
No, there's an axe I'm looking for right now. I know it's there.
All right. Well, if you find it, feel free to interrupt and we'll go to it. Now, I wasn't prepared to deal with this morning, but that's okay. It's all right. But if you want a more thorough treatment of it, there is this textbook that I have at the office that goes into all these issues in great detail. And by the way, he did get his thesis. It was approved. So the book got published. Yes. I was hoping you wouldn't ask that because I don't remember. But it was around the right time, and I think he was arguing for 26 A.D. and 30 A.D. as the two possibilities, but I'd have to check to see which it is. But I think that's, because I think there's two dates about 4 years apart.
I mean, is there a question? I mean, it seems logical if we understand their calendar that we ought to...
Well, that's part of the problem, is that...
some question about how they were depicting.
Well, you run into that same problem trying to nail down the birth of Jesus. We're just not sure precisely what the calendar looked like at that time. We can trace it back to about the 4th or 5th century AD with, you know, precision to the exact day. When you get earlier than that, then you have to kind of read the historical records and say, well, do I trust this record or do I trust that record? And so it's not possible to really nail it down with any precision. You know, like the reference you got in the Bible that really helps is in the days of Quirinius. You know, the census was taken. If you can try to nail down that one, but even that is difficult to pin down to the precise year. But Luke is our best guide. There's a hand over here somewhere. Yes.
Yes. You alluded to the calendar, and that's what confuses a lot of people, because for us, that Jewish calendar is really chaotic, you know, I mean, 13 months and so forth. The other thing, though, a factor is that in the Jewish calendar, the day begins at sundown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we are used to.
Right. So that is a problem. And by the way, this gets into the Seventh-day Adventist issue. I mean, do we really know the calendar precisely enough? I mean, I've used that in talking to some of my Seventh-day Adventist friends. Why make such a big deal about Saturday compared to Sunday? We can't even prove. Of course, the Seventh-day Adventists claim we can nail down the calendar with absolute precision. But people outside that branch say, no, we really can't do it that accurately, in which case we really don't know what their Sabbath was compared to our Sabbath. Yes. You're from a Seventh-day Adventist background, so.
Interesting that officially they have not seemed to be too bothered by the fact that the international day line makes an arbitrary day. Wherever you draw that line, you're arbitrarily saying the day starts there. And if you drew the line in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, then you would have us having a different day. The Sabbath would be on one side of the day versus the other. but we've drawn arbitrarily down the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and probably simply because the explorers went this way, you know.
Right.
You know, they went east and west and kind of...
That's an interesting argument. I mean, that's very good. I mean, the drawing of the date line is totally arbitrary, so why, again, make a big deal over which day compared to another day? We really don't know.
But particularly so, if you're in Australia, that would have tremendous implications. What would be the right day for the seventh-day Sabbath? It could be the first.
So you're trying to tell me there aren't as many Seventh-day Adventists in Australia as there are here?
Well, there are a lot of there.
In fact,
I read a pamphlet by a Seventh-day Adventist lady who was very bothered by this and was trying to argue that we ought to keep the Sabbath from sundown Jerusalem time to sundown Jerusalem time. Wherever it fell around the world, didn't immaterial as long as we kept according to that. So everywhere you need the same 24 hours of sacred time. North of the Arctic Circle, and you get all kinds of problems with Sabbath falling early Friday through early Saturday.
Well, you know, if you're at the North Pole or the South Pole, you got a real problem, because just one step can move you from one day to the next. So, but maybe there aren't too many churches up there, so that may save that problem. Okay, any more issues before we get to the topic at hand? All right.
Thanks.
I got too much stuff up here. Let me drop some of it down. All right. I'll recover this. Here we go. Okay. We've finished, by the way, those of you that are new are kind of doing a Science in the Bible course and looking at Genesis right now, having looked at the scientific evidences for the God of the Bible. We're now going into the scriptures and scientific challenges to the Bible as the error-free Word of God from a secular perspective. And, you know, we're beginning with Genesis 1. We're going to be spending some time in the first 11 chapters of Genesis because, as our surveys and reasons to believe point out, that's the source of over 90% of the objections that people raise to taking the Bible as a perfect text, as opposed to just a human text. And these are the texts they go to claim that it's a flawed book and therefore this is not to be trusted as a source for spiritual or physical guidance. We've spent several weeks now going through the events in Genesis chapter 1. I mean, of all the points that people raise, that's probably the most significant. Many people look at this text and see the order of events described there as something that doesn't square with the established record of nature of science. And so we've made the point that if you correctly identify the frame of reference and initial conditions, the heart of the scientific method, which really comes from the biblical faith, I mean, this is where the scientific method is derived from, and it's really a disciplinary tool, you'll get into trouble if you interpret the text too quickly. But if you correctly establish that frame of reference, the initial conditions, then the 14 events of creation you'll discover are not only correctly described, but in the correct chronological sequence. Yes?
You said I could interrupt.
Yes, you can interrupt.
Acts 16:13. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to the riverside, where we were supposing there would be a place of prayer. This is just before the conversion of Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that Sabbath day... The day of the Sabbaths. So here's another one of those particularly.
Right. And maybe it's referring to this kind of a Sabbath, because this is something this guy brings out in his thesis. Sometimes the two Sabbaths perfectly overlap. You get two Sabbaths on one day. Sometimes they're separated, sometimes they perfectly overlap. So I don't know how the Jews handled that, but it is possible in their calendar that you can get the Passover Sabbath perfectly overlapping the regular Sabbath. So, okay, that's Acts 16:3, is it? Acts 16:13. Okay. Well, we were going to move from Genesis 1 into Genesis 2, and following Genesis 2, I was going to get into the second most critical issue that divides people and looking at the Bible as the error-free word of God divides Christians and it causes secularists to claim it's not credible. And this is an issue that's covered in some depth in this book, Creation and Time. How most people's view of the Bible is it teaches a time scale for creation that is too brief to square with the established record of nature. In particular, there's a lot of mocking about, well, how can you possibly believe that the universe was created in 4004 BC, October 23rd, 9 a.m., 45th meridian time? There actually was an English theologian who calculated the date for the creation of the universe based on what he thought the Bible was communicating in terms of chronology to a precision that was accurate, he claimed, to better than 1 minute. 1 minute precision he was establishing. Now, it's really a whole point. Does the Bible give you 1 minute precision in all of this? But this is the issue I'd like to deal with. I was going to wait till I covered Genesis chapter 2, because the third issue, these are the three issues, the order of events. And the point of ridicule is how can anybody believe the Bible when it says that the plants are created before the sun? Well, you only would get that interpretation if you misidentify the frame of reference. And if you, once you correctly identify it, we find that all 14 events are correctly described in the correct chronological sequence. But a second one is everybody knows that Genesis 2 contradicts Genesis 1. We've kind of gone through that a little bit already, but we'll hit it in the text. Number three are these days of creation. There's six 24-hour periods, and clearly this is in direct contradiction with something we know to be true about the universe and the earth. How do you deal with this? Well, I've been advised by some of you that I probably should cover that issue before I get into the so-called contradictions in Genesis 2. I mean, we've hit them fairly well already, but so we'll do that. We'll take a brief interlude right now, and it will be brief in the sense that I've already dealt with this in considerable detail in this book, which is available, but I'll take you through it, and I'll try to give you a little update, because the book is now 2 years out of date, on where things stand now. And what's encouraging is I see a tremendous amount of progress to healing within the church on this issue, and also progress in trying to communicate the Bible as the Word of God, free of error, to secular audiences in spite of this issue of these 24-hour days that are consecutive. Well, let me just set the emotional stage, and that's kind of how I'd like to do this. I mean, in my book, I tried to focus on the biblical evidences that these days of creation are long periods of time rather than 24-hour periods, and the scientific evidences that are consistent with that, and the scientific evidences against alternate views. And just to kind of set the stage here, you've got three possibilities on taking Genesis 1 literally with respect to these days. They can be six 12-hour periods, six 24-hour periods, or six long time periods. Where the controversy arose is when the Bible was translated from Hebrew into English. And the English language, we have many figurative references to the days, like the days of the Caesar, or the day of the dinosaurs, or the day of Clinton, or the day of Reagan. We refer to a period of time, but we see that as a figurative reference. And whereas the literal references would be 12-hour periods, roughly, or 24-hour periods. So in English, we have two literal definitions for the word day, and we have many figurative uses, whereas in biblical Hebrew, you have three literal definitions for the word that's translated day: 12 hours, 24 hours, and a long period of time. And whereas in the English language, we have well over two dozen words to refer to specific long time periods, things like age, era, and epoch. Within the Hebrew language, again, biblical Hebrew, we have no words at all. Now, making a reference to biblical Hebrew, because modern Hebrew does have a word, when the Jews settled the land of Israel in this century, they expanded the vocabulary of their Hebrew literature, the Hebrew language. But if you're referring to the Hebrew in which the Old Testament was based, it's a smaller vocabulary, and the word definitions are different than they are in modern Hebrew. So whereas in modern Hebrew there is one word for a long period of time, specific to a long period of time, in biblical Hebrew there are zero. So that's just kind of the context for all of this. And right away, that should relieve some of the emotionalism. But there is a lot of emotionalism on this that exists to this day. 1982 Gallup poll, and this poll is repeated every few years, and the most recent polls are really no different. What it demonstrates here is that 44%, not of Christians, but the entire population, this is a survey of the whole U.S. population, 44% hold to a 10,000-year-old creation. 47% hold that all life got here by Darwinian evolution over long periods of time. But what's most alarming to me is the third statistic. 74% of the American population want only their view taught in public schools. So this demonstrates that we got the population split roughly 50-50 on this issue. One group saying, well, it's all special creation on a time scale of less than 10,000 years for everything, human beings, the earth, and the universe. One group says, well, maybe God had a hand in creating the universe, but everything else happens by evolutionary, natural evolutionary processes that took place over billions of years. And evidently, neither group is willing to see any room for discussion of the merits or demerits of the other position. They want only their view taught. So that right away means that we got a problem that extends much beyond the church itself. This isn't just a church issue. This is why we see all these fights on school boards. There was one last year in Vista. A huge fight over this issue broke out in terms of the textbooks that they would employ and what the teachers could say and not say in their biology classrooms. And this is happening all over the country. In fact, there are organizations on both sides. There are organizations that are defending this in courts of law. There are also organizations that are defending this in courts of law. The two most prominent are here in California. You got one up in Berkeley that's saying we got to get rid of all these people who believe in this particular position, or at least to marginalize them to where they have no role in the social, educational, and political fabric of our nation. And then you got an organization here in Southern California that's trying to promote the opposite, that we need to ensure that this position has complete access to the social, political, and educational arena. Now, it goes beyond that. We have people holding to the view that the universe and the earth is only thousands of years old who say of the other camp that these people that are telling you that things have been around for billions of years, they're bluffing. They're not telling you the truth. They violate rules of logic. They make patently false statements. They make a farce of scientific laws. Now, whether or not these charges are true, I would argue that this probably doesn't have a very enduring effect on those that would hold to a view that it would be billions of years old. I mean, you're literally calling them names, and this is how people respond. I mean, you go to a scientist and say, well, in terms of your statements to the public, you're bluffing, you're not logical, you're making false statements, you're a liar, and you're making a farce of science itself. And I said, wait a minute, my employee is in science. I spent all my life training for this position, and you're telling me everything I'm saying is worthless, worse than that, deceitful. And then we have Russell Ackridge, who makes the point that of all the scientists, astronomers are the ones that are really the most evil. That astronomers are high priests of the decades-old cult of the Big Bang myth, and its persuasive speakers have deceived an unsuspecting public. Now, yeah, that's a little bit rough. Especially when I'm up here as an astronomer. And I think of all the years I've been around as an astronomer, looking at my peers and saying, persuasive speakers? Who are they kidding? I've had them as professors. I mean, boy, if we weren't highly motivated to take these classes, we wouldn't be here. So, although I will have to admit that at least one or two are indeed persuasive speakers. Now, the scientific community, those outside the Christian concourse have also responded with a similar kind of language. Let me give you a couple of quotes. This one is from Michael Roos, and he's up there in Canada. He's a science historian. And he says, there are degrees of being wrong. The creationists are at the bottom of the scale. They pull every trick in the book to justify their position. Indeed, at times they verge right over into the downright dishonest. Their arguments are rotten through and through. Now again, this isn't going to endear many people on the opposite side of the fence to their position. It's name-calling. And it just makes people angry, upset, and makes people get polarized. It just makes them more rigid into their position. And what I notice on both sides of the fence, I mean, I'm on the mailing list of the two organizations I'm referring to, is that both of them claim to be persecuted. We are being persecuted by certain elements of society for holding to what we believe is scientifically correct. And they raise money on the persecution thing. One thing I would always say in terms of apologetics issues, be careful when people try to garner support from you with the claim that we are being persecuted. I mean, we heard this morning in the service that the church in the first century was greatly advanced through persecution. But it was persecution aimed at Jesus Christ rather than persecution aimed at human behavior. And there are two ways you can be persecuted. You can be persecuted for standing for the truth, for standing what is right, or you can be persecuted for standing what's truthful and right, but it's because you're doing it obnoxiously and people are reacting to your obnoxious nature rather than what you stand for. So there's two ways you can be persecuted. And I'd like to suggest that these kinds of comments are obnoxious to astronomers, and likewise the comment that creationists are rotten through and through in their arguments and are dishonest, that's also obnoxious. So even if they were right, they would be getting persecution, but not for the right reasons. And so when people say, hey, you know, look what the other people are doing to us, well, maybe you need to look at what kinds of things are being said. So the problem is when people speak like this of those who disagree with them, it makes it very difficult to reconcile the two camps. So let's not be surprised that the reconciliation is going to be difficult. And just to put this in some kind of context, it wasn't until 1981 that the Roman Catholic Church officially forgave Galileo for his audacity at making the point that he was correctly interpreting Psalm 104 when the Roman Catholic leaders were incorrectly interpreting Psalm 104. Now, if you look into the history of that whole event, 300 years ago, the Roman Catholic Church admitted that they were wrong in their conclusions about Galileo's statements. But it took 300 years to officially forgive. And the reason why it took so long, the emotions were so deep-seated. Statements have been made in both sides of the fence that made it very difficult for people to back down with any degree of humility. Unfortunately, I think we see a similar situation here. Even when both sides realize what's right, who's correct, what's the resolution here, it's not going to come easy. It's not going to be easy for these people to shake hands with one another and say, well, we now are able to agree on the appropriate interpretation of the scientific record and the biblical text. I don't think that's going to happen easily because of the kinds of statements that have been said. What it will take is something akin to what the Roman Catholic Church was able to say, you know, we were wrong in the way we treated Galileo. And that's what's going to take here. People are going to say, well, you know, if Russell Ackridge should come out and say, you know, my statements about these high priests and their persuasive ability to speak and deceive an unsuspecting public, I was wrong in charging evil motives to what they were doing. And if people can admit that they were wrong in charging evil motives to people on the other side, I think we can get somewhere, but I'm not expecting that to happen. Usually such acts of humility are rare in issues of biblical controversy. However, yes. They admitted right away that their stand was wrong. By right away, I mean within a decade. within a decade after the trial, the Roman Catholic Church said, all right, it's not geocentrism, it's heliocentrism. We were wrong on that. But it took them centuries to admit that the way they had handled the case was not appropriate. And in one sense, the Roman Catholic Church is still not willing to state that the layman has equal position in challenging issues of biblical interpretation as the ones who've been trained in the eucentric idea. So there were some that were saying, I mean, there were, you know, even the Pope was saying it was heliocentric rather than geocentric. I think because the Pope initially backed Galileo and said this is the way to go. But he changed his position because certain Roman Catholic priests and curates came to him and said, no, wait a minute, there's a bigger issue here. The bigger issue is we're allowing laymen to correct us on biblical interpretation. That we can't tolerate. And so they took Galileo to court. Even though there were people trying him, we realized he was right. They said there's a bigger issue at stake here. Now, I'd like to suggest that a lot of that has been resolved in the Roman Catholic Church, but not to the degree, I mean, after all, it was resolved completely, then they'd be Protestants. And, you know, I don't think that's going to happen in our lifetime. So that was really the whole point. And often when people look at this in history, whether they be Roman Catholics or Protestants or total secularists, I mean, read all the books you can find on the Galileo trial. Not very many of them make that central point that the real issue was a layman challenging the authority of people who had spent all their lives in training to be interpreters of the text and placing himself on an equal footing. And in many respects, you can read the way Galileo was doing this. He was not literally saying that he was equal. He was saying he was better. And that was a bit much for, in fact, I'd say it's a bit much for theologians today to take. Hey, not just in the Roman Catholic arena, you know, try going to a seminary as a layman and saying, I don't care how much education you guys have had, you are wrong on this issue. That's probably not the most diplomatic way to go about it. And one thing you can easily gain from the life of Galileo, he was not a diplomat.
It may not be diplomatic, but this is exactly what the Lord did with the Pharisees.
Yes.
You had all this training, but you're wrong.
Right.
He did the same thing.
Right?
He got in trouble, too.
He got in trouble, too, right?
So, to him, the greater issue was not whether he was diplomatic or not.
Right. Right.
But realize he was the only one alive who didn't have any ulterior motives or pride motives or just have to be inappropriate.
Yeah, that's a good point, Kathy, that because he is a God and because he's perfect, he would have no need for the kind of diplomacy that the rest of us would need. And really, I'm not talking so much about diplomacy as a humility. And if you read what Galileo said, we don't know the tone of his voice, but what you read about letters from friends is that he was behaving very audaciously towards these curates. And it was not the kind of humble appeal that would be necessary, and maybe he was a bit prideful in thinking that as one man, he could challenge the entire Roman Catholic hierarchy on this issue. He was so convinced he was right, and he was right. He had the evidence right there in front of him. And how often it is that, hey, even on this issue, the evidence is so obvious that anyone looking at it would realize that they've been wrong on interpreting this text, and they should come around. What I'd like to suggest is that this issue is so emotionally charged that simply giving people overwhelming scientific proof or overwhelming biblical proof isn't going to do it. It's going to take more than that to resolve this issue. And a lot has happened in the last couple of years, but it's going to take more time than that, and it's going to take a lot more humility than it is evidence. The evidence is there, just like the evidence was there in the days of Galileo. Yeah.
I read that Galileo thought he had the approval before he released his text.
He did. I forget the gentleman's name that was Pope, but the Pope backed him in the publication of his heliocentric interpretation. The Pope was convinced that Galileo was right. That's why I made this comment to Tony. The Pope knew all along it was heliocentric. He saw the evidence. He agreed with Galileo. But it was other cardinals that came to him. Several cardinals came to the Pope and said, you must reverse your position. And it wasn't so much on the heliocentric issue, but you know, we cannot tolerate our church taking a different position based on the appeal of a single layman. Now, if it came within the church, and maybe that's a better way Galileo could have handled it, and say, look, I don't want to publish this. I'll give it to you. Publish it under your name. But if it came out under the pen of one of the cardinals, bishops, a council of bishops, or the Pope himself, this whole thing could have been avoided. It would have been dishonest, right? Moreover, Galileo was the astronomer. It really should have come from him, but it was nothing like getting a dozen co-authors. So this is done in publishing today, by the way. voluntary plagiarism, right? So, okay. I'd like to move on to the second point. This is a deeper issue, and it's not only dividing atheists against Christians, but Christians against Christians. Here's a comment from Henry Morris, and by the way, his Institute for Creation Research is not the Young Earth organization that's challenging these issues in the courts. They split off with an organization that is doing it. They're both in San Diego, both headquartered in San Diego. But he was the one that said, look, we're going to work at trying to educate people. We're not going to fight this in the courts. Whereas another Young Earth organization says, we're going to take the court route rather than the education route. So that's why they call themselves the Institute for Creation Research, because they see their role as education rather than, Kelly Seagraves is the one heading up the organization and saying we got to take it to the courts. So that was a split that took place in the 1970s. But Henry wrote a piece where he said, insistence on an ancient earth is purity because of the philosophic necessity to justify evolution and the pantheistic religion of eternal matter. And this is an accusation being made towards Christians. He is warning Christians that by insisting on an ancient earth, they're really supporting an evolutionary paradigm or a pantheistic religion of eternal matter. And The Long War Against God, a full-length book that was recently published by Henry Morris, he says, if it were not for the compromising attitude in this vital doctrine of recent creation, evolutionary humanism would have long since have been defeated. His point is that the church is simply held strong and united on interpreting the days of six 24-hour periods, then evolutionary humanism would have been gone a long time ago. Perhaps the most damaging statement comes from his son, John Morris, who is now the president of the Institute for Creation Research, where he says, no church should sanction a pastor, Sunday school leader, deacon, elder, or even a Bible study leader who knowledgeably and purposely errs on the Earth's age. In other words, he was answering the question. Somebody wrote into the Institute for Creation Research saying, well, can people join the church if they believe in billions of years instead of thousands? And John's point is, well, if they're new Christians, they're not fully matured yet, then we can understand them believing in billions, but we bring them into the church, we educate them. So he was making the point, no, we shouldn't reject a person for church membership just because they believe in billions, because they might be immature, but certainly we shouldn't allow someone who believes in billions to take a role as a leader within the church. And then Henry and John wrote another book where they said, such compromises on the age of the earth and the universe do not lead to soul winning or spiritual growth, but to apostasy. Now, again, we got a problem here. You're saying you can't be a leader, and moreover, you're an apostate, and you have no interest in bringing people to faith in Jesus Christ, or you're leading people down the path of evolutionary naturalism. This really is not a whole lot different than saying that these people are persuasive speakers deceiving an unsuspecting public. And so even within the Christian community, you got people shouting names at one another. Now, what has been helpful is that the name-calling hasn't been that bad from the old Earth camp towards the young Earth camp, although there have been some statements coming out of those holding to the statement of or holding to the position of theistic evolution. And they've been making statements that are similar to those that are coming from the likes of Michael Roos. Where this is all tied together is by the famous atheist Steve Allen, the fellow who was on television a few years back, who sees himself as television's intellectual, at least the American intellectual. And he wrote a book called Steve Allen on the Bible, Religion, and Morality. And in it he says, by the way, he knows a lot about the Christian faith because he's married to an evangelical Christian. Interesting marriage where you got an evangelical Christian as the wife and a prominent atheist skeptic as the husband. And they support one another and love one another, even though they really disagree tremendously on a number of issues. But he says, the fundamentalist argument against the scientific assertion of the great age of our planet to the effect that God created the Earth only 6,000 years ago, including fossils embedded in rocks, is unworthy of serious discussion. And the reason I read this, this is really similar to the statements that are coming from Christians who hold to theistic evolution. They say this is so obviously well proven that to even discuss it is really not worthy of serious discussion. It is now recognized by every intelligent and informed person that the two Genesis accounts cannot be reconciled, and that Genesis and science cannot be reconciled. Nor should we be guilty of the error of assuming that the problem relates only to Genesis. It touches the New Testament as well. And so Steve Allen makes a connection between the age of the Earth, the age of the universe issue, the reliability of Genesis 1 and 2, the two accounts contradicting one another, and he says, if you think this is just a Genesis problem, you're fooling yourself. This affects our understanding of the New Testament as well. What he's getting at here is that we have the New Testament writers, especially in the Gospels, and even the words of Jesus himself, quoting from Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And they're quoting from it as if the text is literally true. So he says that this point about the reliability and credibility scientifically of Genesis 1, 2, and 3 isn't just a Genesis problem. It affects the New Testament. It affects the Christian faith. And I think that's what's made this issue so critical, because there are those within the young earth creationist camp who've made that point. If you give any way on Genesis, the whole gospel falls like a pack of cards, like a house of cards. And, you know, I would have got to agree with both of them that, yes, Jesus does quote from these creation texts, from both of them. And evidently Jesus saw them as texts that were consistent and true in a literal sense. So it's essential that we come up with some answers to this, otherwise we're stuck with Steve Allen's conclusion. But I think what's made this particularly difficult to reconcile within the Christian camp is this theorem that's developed at length by John and Henry Morse of the Institute for Creation Research. They don't call it a theorem. I refer to it as a theorem. But what you find in these three books I've referred to is this equating within the Christian camp and outside the Christian camp, old earth beliefs equal evolutionism. And so they take great pains to make the connection between, if you believe in an old earth, that's the same thing as saying evolutionism. And what they mean by evolutionism is natural evolutionism, where natural processes alone are responsible for all the changes we see in life here on planet Earth. And then they spend hundreds of pages making the connection between evolutionism and what they refer to as unmitigated evil. And in the book Creation and Time, I try to give you some examples of what they mean by that. They might make the point that the philosophy of evolutionism is really equivalent to what's undergirding homosexuality, promiscuity, drug abuse, and they go on down the list. So they look at the divorce issue, the breakdown of the family, and all of these issues are really tied down to social Darwinism. And I would have to agree that their points are well taken. If you really follow the philosophy that undergirds social Darwinism, then it does indeed form the philosophical foundation of the breakdown of the family, homosexuality, the gay, lesbian lifestyle, abortions, euthanasia. I mean, they make a long list of what's guiding all of this. However, it's not true that all scientists who believe in naturalism are adopting the philosophy of social Darwinism. And this has led to a lot of angry response from the secular camp to say, we are physical Darwinists, but we are not social Darwinists. On the other hand, the philosophy that undergirds physical Darwinism really is the same philosophy that undergirds social Darwinism. But I think where these gentlemen have been incorrect is assuming that the people promoting evolutionism in the secular camp and the Christian camp are philosophically astute enough to realize that they're one and the same thing. There's a lot of naivete here that's not taken into account. But as a result of these two equations, old earth beliefs are evil, thus old earthers are evil, which is what justifies their comments. And in my book, I give you some statements as to what these comments are like. Ravening wolves, apostates, workers of the devil, tools of Satan, etc. These are charges laid towards Christians. Now, how do you resolve all of this? By talking about it next week, is what Tom is telling me. But very quickly, we would begin by making the same points we made at the beginning of this section of how do you handle science and faith and Bible issues. You make the point that the Bible makes it really clear that the revelation we get through nature is identical to the revelation we get through the words of the Bible. The heavens do declare the glory of God. Their words are written upon the heavens for all of us to read. Part of the Word of God would be the record of nature. It's not just the 66 books of the Bible. This is something that really helped my discussions at Toccoa Falls College, also at a couple of churches I spoke at in Atlanta, is that we need to realize that there's at least 68 books that make up the Word of God. The 66 books of the Bible, the record of nature, and there is a conscience God has given each of us. God has written His words upon the hearts of each one of us that we would know His law. The Ten Commandments have been written, literally, by God in each of our hearts. We have a conscience. So a conscience would be a 68th book. So when we talk about the Word of God, we need to realize that it's broader than the 66 books of the Bible. The Bible is inspired by God. The universe is created by God. We're told in the Bible it's impossible for God to lie. Therefore, the words of the Bible and the facts of nature must agree. The reason why they don't agree is that we have human interpretation getting in the way. And so this controversy has within it a great opportunity. We have a perceived contradiction here, both within the camp of Christians and outside the camp of Christians, but recognizing that God reveals Himself without error through all of the 66 books He has given to us, then we simply need to find out where the faulty human interpretation lies. And how do we do that? We test all things and hold fast what is good and true. Is that going to be easy to do? No. One of the things we have to do is overcome a secular bias about faith. I got to see this on television this week watching the news about this event in Rancho Santa Fe. Is that once again we're seeing put on front of the evening news this idea that in terms of belief about God, and Christians in particular, we follow a blind faith. And what they're saying about these cults, and it's true about the cults, they were going into this without testing. But the implication was that's true of all believers, all those people that are following religion. This is not what the Bible encourages. We're not just to blindly believe what we've been told. or what we think is being told to us through the words of the Bible or the facts of nature or what's written upon our conscience, we're to put it to the test. Faith, the Greek word for faith, the conviction of the truth of anything, obedience to established truth, acting upon what has been established to be true. But what I'm going to do next week is get you into the heart of this theorem that we've been dealing with. This theorem that I close with, if I can find it. I perhaps can't find it. But if we can demonstrate that the theorem about old earth beliefs are evil, and therefore people believe in an old earth are evil, and it's all centered on evolutionism, if we can unravel that particular theorem, there we have the basis for reconciliation. I think that's the only basis we have for reconciliation. Let's examine the tenets of that theorem and see if we can see what's really going on. And what I'm going to be suggesting is this. The age of the universe, the age of the earth, is not the issue. The real issue, how efficiently do the mechanisms of natural process evolution really work? And it's really dividing people within the church. One group of Christians believe that they're extremely efficient. Another group believes that they're not efficient at all. And if we can resolve that particular issue, then this other thing will take care of itself. And I'm just going to tell some anecdotes in the next few weeks of how I've had chances to see that actually play out. It really does work. But if you stick with the age of the universe, you're on an issue that's so emotional, people aren't going to see their way through it, even though the evidence is incontrovertible. It's not going to happen, just like in the days of Galileo. People were debating the wrong issue. It was an issue that was really clear-cut from a strictly non-emotional perspective. But there are emotions here, and therefore we need to deal with the deeper problems. Okay. Let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day that gives us an opportunity to think about what you did 2,000 years ago, the sacrifice you made in our behalf, and how you demonstrated that you are the conqueror of all evil, the conqueror of death itself, and that you have the power, you have the power to deliver anyone. If you can raise yourself bodily from the dead, you can raise anyone bodily from the dead. Thank you for demonstrating that power to us so clearly, and thank you for giving us the historical context that makes it so easy to demonstrably prove, and that we can realize that indeed there is no shadow of doubt that you've been raised bodily from the dead. Thank you for doing that for us. Thank you for conquering death. Thank you for showing this away, and thank you for offering to us the gift of eternal life. Help us to better communicate the evidences that all this is true, so that many may come to know you as Lord and Savior in these last days. In Jesus' name, amen.